and welcome to the kickoff event for Silicon Valley Reads 2015, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, the Santa Clara County Library, San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jill Bourne. I'm the City Librarian and Director of the San Jose Public Library. It is my pleasure to introduce the authors of this year's Silicon Valley Reads, Noviolet Bulawayo, Christina Enriquez, and Bikmin Nguyen. First, Noviolet Bulawayo grew up in Zimbabwe and is the author of We Need New Names. Her novel received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize Art Seidenbaum Award for First Fiction, the Penn Hemingway Award, and was the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Fiction Selection. It was also shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and selected to the New York Times Notable Books of 2013 list. Noviolet earned her MFA at Cornell University, where she was a recipient of the Truman Capote Fellowship. She was a Stegner Fellow at Stanford University, where she now teaches as a Jones Lecturer in Fiction. Christina Enriquez is the author of The Book of Unknown Americans. Her previous work, Come Together, Fall Apart, was a New York Times Editor's Choice selection, and she was recognized by the Virginia Quarterly Review as one of fiction's new luminaries. Christina is a recipient of the Alfredo Cisneros Del Moral Foundation Award. She also graduated from Northwestern University and completed her studies at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And Bikmin Nguyen is the author of Stealing Buddha's Dinner. The memoir received the Penn Herald Award and was a Chicago Tribune Best Book of the Year. Beth is the author of 3 books, including Short Girls and Pioneer Girl, and has co-edited 3 anthologies. She received her MFA in creative writing from the University of Michigan and currently teaches in the writing program at the University of San Francisco. And moderating tonight's conversation is Sal Pizarro, columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Noviolet Bulawayo, Christina Enriquez, Bikmin Nguyen, and Sal Pizarro.
So I'd like to thank the 3 of you for being here and all of you for being here tonight. This is the first time for Silicon Valley Reads that we've had 3 authors, and we're very happy to welcome you all. But of course, that means with this interview, we are going to have a lot to cover with a lot of voices, and we are going to try to make sure everybody gets heard. So let me start off. In reading the 3 books, I thought that while the stories are obviously very different and powerful in their own ways, there are some common themes to the immigrant experience that appear in all of them. And it was fascinating to see how you each approached those themes. But what I'd like to hear is, I know each story that you told started from someplace in your life, and clearly in your case, Beth, it was, you know, your actual life that you were writing about in your memoir. So I'd love to hear from you how your life informed the story that you told. So, Beth, why don't we start with you?
Okay, well, since my book is nonfiction, that was an easier task because the book is a true account of how I grew up in the Midwest in Michigan as a child of immigrants. And I never intended to write a memoir. I think a lot of memoirists have that experience. But the story of my family leaving Vietnam in 1975, just before the fall of Saigon, and landing in Michigan, of all places, as refugees, starting over, it was such a big, true story for me that I had to write it down as something true before I could go on with my writing career. At least that's how it felt to me at the time, because it was the story that I'd been given. It was not something that I chose, but it's such a part of my family's story, and it's the reason why I'm here, that I needed to deal with it. In fact, it's probably the thing that made me become a writer. And so that all the ideas in that book about remaking one's life and reinvention and struggling to fit in. All those were ideas that I, you know, kept thinking about, and I still think about all the time, and became just the biggest themes in that book. Also, through the metaphor of food, which is really important to my family, and actually it's probably important to every immigrant family.
We're going to be talking about food in a little while, trust me. Christina?
First of all, thank you guys for coming. Can you hear me? Not really? Okay, let's see if we slide this up. Can you hear me now? Yes? Okay. Thank you all for coming out tonight, first of all. Just there's like a million things you could be doing. And I live in Chicago, where we're buried under about 2 feet of snow. So it's so beautiful here that I can't imagine why you're not outside doing things. So thank you all for coming. My book started really, it was inspired by my father. And my dad came from Panama to the United States in 1971. And he came to Delaware to study chemical engineering. And he thought he would get his degree and then he would go back to Panama. But he ended up meeting my mom, who coincidentally had gone to Panama a few years earlier as a foreign exchange student. So when my dad came to Delaware and ended up living down the street from her, her mom encouraged her to go over and introduce herself to him because they had something in common. And it turns out, I mean, she was majoring in Spanish and he needed to learn English and sort of, you know, fate was written. So he's been here for more than 40 years now, and my mom, who, they still live in Delaware, and my mom is a translator for the school district there, and she works with a lot of immigrant families. And we were talking one day about the way that Latino immigrants are typically portrayed in American media, and she said something along the lines of, you know, no one from the newspaper is ever going to call Pop and ask him for his story. And I thought, you know, that that was true to some extent and that it was a shame, and that as a writer I had the power to tell his story and stories like his, which, you know, I told him this at one point. I said, I dedicated the book to him and I told him, you know, that I wanted to share his story, and he said, what story? I don't have a story. But I think, to me, that was exactly the point. It was a very ordinary story, and that's why it was important. And I think as fiction writers and as writers in general, those are often the stories that are really important to us, are the ordinary stories, and trying to make them somehow extraordinary on the page. So it all started, yeah, with that, with the idea that maybe I would tell these very ordinary stories of immigrants from all over Latin America.
Excellent. Noelle?
Good evening, and thank you all for being here. I left home when I was 18 to come here for college, and I remember how excited I was to leave, that I did not even think about the question of going back until I found myself not able to go home for the at least 13 years. And during that time, that's when I started getting interested in storytelling. And for some reason, everything I wrote had something to do with the country that I left behind but could not go to. So for me, writing about home was a way of staying connected with my roots, with my country, with my family, so that when I began working on We Need New Names, it really wasn't a question of, you know, what I was going to write about. At the same time, Zimbabwe was coming undone in ways that I'd never seen during my time there. So I found myself coping with the political situation, with the unrest through writing. I wasn't thinking about bringing Darling over to the U.S. until I finished the Zimbabwean section, and I became interested in the journeys of people who were leaving the country in droves in search of greener pastures. And I remember I wrote at a time when social media, when Facebook was becoming a big thing, and a lot of my high school friends, you know, were Facebooking from all over, and it just became urgent, I guess, to follow that that narrative of young people leaving and going to other countries. And of course, I had to look in the mirror and into my own journey, leaving Zim to Kalamazoo, Michigan. And that's where the self, I guess, became part of what I was doing.
Right. Well, that theme of staying connected, Beth, you kind of mentioned, you know, staying connected with the homeland, and a lot of it seems to happen through food. And even in We Need New Names, you've got the guava that brings back memories. And the discovery of the supermarket that sells Mexican food in the Book of Unknown Americans, where that's the connection to home as opposed to whatever they call salsa. You know, they call this salsa, but it's not. And then, of course, you've got all of your grandmother's food that she's making, that is the connection to the homeland. And so holding on to those culinary traditions seemed to be a really good way to keep the culture continuing. But then you've got the other side where everyone gives in at some point to the sweet, sweet taste of McDonald's French fries. Mm-hmm. And they say this, I am an American now because I go to McDonald's. And in fact, we've even got a exhibit as part of the program called Mooncakes, Churros, and Cherry Pie at De Anza College. It's an art exhibit that sort of examines this connection. But how conscious were you as writers of incorporating food as part of the story? Whoever wants to jump in, go ahead.
I mean, I think it was a big part for me. I mean, that's one of the major places that I think culture lives, is in people's food. And so it was important for me. My book is primarily about this family from Mexico who comes to the United States because their daughter has suffered a brain injury and they want to get her better care. And it just seemed like you would have to address the issue of food at some point. And they're, you know, as you pointed out, Sal, their thrill at finding a grocery store that sold some of the things that they could find at home, and their utter disappointment when they go to a gas station and try to buy salsa and look at it and realize that it's not really the real thing. And there's sort of these ongoing jokes throughout the book, too, about different stereotypes that plague, I think, Hispanics. And one of them that comes up is about tacos. And the other main family in the book is from Panama, and they're complaining about how everybody thinks they like tacos, but they don't even eat tacos in Panama. You know, like that's just not. But, you know, everyone's conflating the area as sort of this one monolithic entity. So, I mean, food, there's a lot of food in the book, and there's a pivotal scene where they've sort of run out of money or are low on money, and so they discover oatmeal. Which they think is an American delicacy, and they go and try to prepare it, and they prepare it badly. They don't realize that the longer it sits, the harder it will get. And so they make it really early, and then they try to eat it later, and there's sort of a funny scene where they're doing that. But that's kind of their, you know, indoctrination into the United States then. That's the other side of it, is them trying to, you know, assimilate and eat what they think of as American foods.
Well, I think that immigrants generally will give up so much to try to fit in. You know, immigrants, they give up a lot of what they wear, a lot of language, a lot of customs, but the one thing they'll never give up is their food culture. And whether that remains a secret inside the house only, or it becomes a part of the rest of culture through restaurants, that's the thing that immigrants have to hang on to, and it's the biggest, one of the biggest ways they can have to transmit their culture. And that was definitely true in my Vietnamese family. But I also grew up, you know, in the deep Midwest in the deep 1980s, and I did not want Vietnamese food. I wanted McDonald's. I wanted Wonder Bread, literally. And food created a very clear divide, a very clear binary. One was American and one was Vietnamese. And everybody I knew at school was American, and I wanted to be one of them. So that's what I did, you know. I measured my life by, you know, the Pringles I could bring in my school lunchbox. And if I could bring Pringles, then it was a good day. And I had triumphed for just a moment because I felt like a real American because of those Pringles. And so when I look back on all that, you know, as a writer, it becomes just a very clear metaphor as a way to construct and think about how our identity is shaped by food cultures and by consumerism.
And that's the consumerism angle, you know, really keys into the second half concerning food of your book, Noviolet, because suddenly Darling's in this place with food everywhere, and as opposed to in Zimbabwe where they were hungry and they were looking, you know, they ate so many guavas it caused them problems.
Oh yes, and not only is she suddenly surrounded by plenty, but there's also this issue of food being a problem, because you see her aunt Faustalina being obsessed with weight, trying not to eat. On the other hand, you see TK, Darling's cousin, kind of eating too much. I was interested in how, you know, food can translate across different spaces. What happens when there's too much of it, and what happens when there's not enough? But coming back to the question of identity, I am absolutely excited by how something like food or even music can mean so much to people who have nothing. You know, if I were to make dinner and call my Zimbabwean friends, I just need to send one text or email, tell them what I'm cooking, and they will definitely show up. It becomes more than food. It becomes, it leads to stories about home. Somehow we get transported to a space that, for one reason or another, you know, some of them cannot go. Some of us are able to go, but we feel like food brings home to wherever we are.
I thought it was interesting in the books, and I feel like I'm the guy sort of connecting the wires here in a way, having read all three books that, which I hope many of you have. If you haven't, you still have time. They're very good reads. All of your protagonists, Darling and We Need Your Names, both Mayor and Maribel, in the book of Unknown Americans, and then you yourself, Beth, you know, in your memoir, you didn't make the decision. The protagonists did not make the decision themselves to leave their homeland. It was in each book, it's made by an adult, and they are brought to a new place, not so much against their will, but certainly they didn't make the affirmative decision. And each of them has a different experience, and you had a different experience than your father did. But do you think whether or not you make that decision to sever your ties, to leave your homeland, does that make a difference in how well you can transition as an immigrant, as opposed to, say, a child who did not? Now, you yourself made the decision. You came here to go to college.
Oh, yes. I was 18. I was talking about this yesterday. I had a reading in the city, and at 18 in my culture, you are considered a child, so you are told that you're done with high school, you are going to go and study. It makes a difference when I think of children even younger, and I was interested especially in Zimbabweans who crossed illegally to countries like South Africa. And I was also interested in children crossing by themselves without adults. And I think in such a situation, it becomes very different and very difficult because, number one, they really don't have the protection of the law, and so anything can happen. They get there and they are not promised anything, you know, and for the most part, you know, without any support system. And also, I mean, they know they are illegal and they will try and hide even from people who would otherwise help them. So I feel like the immigrant experience becomes much more bleaker than it would be for an adult who is in control, who has the resources and the connections to allow them to forge a home in the new space.
Would either of you agree with that or have a different experience?
Well, yeah, I think Stanley Buddha's Dinner is really about childhood. And to me, the experience of childhood is the most universal one, in that it is all about trying to find your identity. And that creates a parallel with the experience of being an immigrant. I didn't choose to be a refugee. That was a choice of my parents and my grandmother. And I'm incredibly grateful for their decision and the bravery it took to make that decision. Although I didn't choose it, I feel like I have spent my life sort of dealing with the consequences of it and thinking about what it was like. I think about it all the time, and this April is the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and every April 29th, I think about it, especially what it must have been like to make that huge decision to leave, to just to say, okay, I have 10 minutes to get everything that I have and leave, and I don't know where I'm going or if I'm going to get out or if I'm going to survive or what's going to happen to me or my children. And I cannot imagine that. I really cannot. And I think that the fact that I can't imagine it is the greatest gift that my family could have given me, that it's this point of not being able to know that kind of you know, suffering, really. So I feel like it's the decision wasn't mine, but I think about it all the time and what it must have been like. And that's one of the reasons why I keep writing about the immigrant experience.
I think that seems right. I mean, for me, I was born in Delaware and mostly grew up there, although I moved around a lot as a kid. You know, but I thought of myself as American, still think of myself as American, although as I've gotten older, people like to tell me that I'm Panamanian American, and then some people like to tell me that I'm Latina, which was like news to me. But it's true that, so none of it was my experience, but in some ways, my dad's experience has had all these reverberations for me, especially in terms of thinking about what am I, where do I belong? And I think that is those are some questions that I've funneled into my fiction and into this book in particular. I mean, the most personal line for me in the book is one where Mayor, who's a 16-year-old boy whose parents had brought him when he was a young boy from Panama to the United States, and he says, like, all the kids at school are making fun of him, and some of these are my experiences, that people are calling him a Pan, short for Panamanian, and telling him to, like, go back through the canal. And I remember when I was in high school and I had friends over, and, you know, like, your parents keep baking soda in the freezer just to keep it fresh. They had it in a Tupperware for some reason instead of, like, in the Arm and Hammer box. And a friend of mine came over, and he was joking and saying, oh, my gosh, you have cocaine because you're related to Noriega. Like, you know, there's, like, all this kind of stuff going on, even though, to me, I was, like, 100% completely American. Right. It was not something I had really confronted or considered. But so the line in the book that Mayor says is that he didn't feel the thing he was supposed to claim, and he couldn't claim the thing he was supposed to feel. Like, he's so stuck somewhere in between. And I always sort of feel that way. I mean, when I go and visit Panama, all of my dad's family still lives there, and we go and we visit pretty much every year. And it's always weird for me, even in the airport, to get in it's like, what line am I going to get in? Am I getting in the Panamanian line because I have, you know, my cédula for Panama, my ID card? Or am I getting in the American line? Like, I didn't even know where to go when I get to the airport. You know, it's simple things like that, but it's the reverberations of my father's decision are things that I think about all the time, like that saying.
And it's quite interesting to see those effects on children, because mm-hmm. I feel like adults have the language to talk about mm-hmm. these things, but children of immigrants who have never seen the homeland, for instance, who were born and belong here, but then sometimes don't necessarily fit in. I feel like it's hard for them to even talk about what it is that they're going through, which is part of what drove me to a young protagonist.
Right, because she starts out, she's 10 years old, she grows up during the book, but mm-hmm. but her perception of what America is very different as a young child than what she learns as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And that was something I think is also another theme that carries through the books, is there's this mythical America that people think of, and it's through the media and it's through movies and TV, and then everyone arrives and they realize, ooh, it's not like it is on TV. It's mm-hmm. both in good and bad ways. You know, it creates a tug point. And we were talking about returning. You know, is it to return to the native land? I mean, you've been to Panama. You describe your experience back in Vietnam. How much does an immigrant need to return to their native land to sort of hold, whether it's their, you know, personal land or the land of their forefathers and their parents, to maintain that connection? Is that a really important thing for you to do?
I think it's been important for my dad. I'm just going to speak a little bit on his behalf, but it's also been really conflicting. I think it's really hard for him now, after having lived here for so long, to go back to Panama and to feel like that's not his country anymore quite either. You know, like that the country has changed in so many ways and it has passed him by. And so he goes there now, and if someone asks for directions, like, he doesn't know anymore. And I think that's really painful for him. To feel like, and at the same time, even though he's been here for more than 40 years, I know that he doesn't feel totally like he fits in here. So, I don't know.
There's a cost both ways.
Yeah.
Definitely. It is important to go back, if anything, for the connection, and to know that you still have access to your homeland. I think it does something to the spirit. But I do agree that when you return, especially with people who have been away for quite a while, it is possible to get there and discover that the country has moved on without you, especially in spaces where upheaval happens and things and culture can change very, very quickly. You get back and you realize that you are one of them, but you are also not one of them. Just like you are also not of the space where you are coming from. It's a struggle. But that said, for me, it still remains important to go back. Most of my family are still back home. I still speak the language. I get there and find a way to fit in and belong. I realize that it also improves my relationship with this country as well, to know that I do have the mobility to negotiate both spaces.
You are listening to a broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. Become a member of the Commonwealth Club and support the club and its radio broadcast by visiting www.commonwealthclub.org or by calling toll-free 1-800-933-7548. That's 800-933-7548 or commonwealthclub.org.
I've only been to Vietnam once in my early 20s, and what I discovered when I went there was that I'm not Vietnamese, I'm actually American. And all my relatives, I didn't even have to say a word. They would say, oh, Americans here. And they would all feed me French fries. Like, I had so many French fries in Vietnam. Very little Vietnamese food. Because they thought, oh, well, it's American, she needs to eat French fries. So I had spent my whole life basically feeling like I was not American enough. And then I go to Vietnam with my grandmother, and I'm like, wait a second, I'm actually not Vietnamese enough. And so that was very troubling. And I don't actually think of Vietnam as my homeland in a way. It is technically so, because I was born there, but I was 8 months old and my family came here, and I think of myself as completely American, you know, because my language, my thoughts, my cultural knowledge is all American. So it's sort of an ongoing struggle for me to try to figure out how Vietnamese I am, or how Vietnamese I'm supposed to be. And a lot of it is, you know, the question of expectation. Mm-hmm. And the question I'm always getting now that I have children is, oh, are you teaching your children Vietnamese? And I'm like, no, because my Vietnamese is really bad. And then I feel guilty all over again.
Are you teaching them English, though?
They do know English and Spanish. Oh.
Better than most of us.
It's better than my kids.
What's comforting, though, is that we are not alone. That, like, right now we're living at a time where people are from all over the world. So you look anywhere and you see somebody who has a story like your own, who knows something about living and arriving. So I just think it's one of the realities of our time. In as much as there is the aspect of struggle, it's also, you know, it's also part of who we are. It's also part of the time, you know.
Yeah. Now, you all set out to write stories that you needed to tell. I don't think you really intended to be grouped together under the label of immigrant writer, as we have sort of done here with our theme. But, you know, this is what we've done, so we're going to say, you are our immigration experts now at the moment. Well, what has the reaction been? Because each of your books spoke to a different community, or in some cases, more than one community. And what has your reaction been from those communities to your books? In what ways have they resonated? Have people said, well, that's not what my experience was, or you got it all wrong, or they're like, yes, that's what happened?
You know, for me, I get a lot of responses from people who are not immigrants or who are not Asian American, who had the kind of childhoods that I coveted, and they will tell me, how you felt in your book is how I felt. And that to me is always so amazing, because, you know, the blonde, blue-eyed girl I thought had the perfect life did not have the perfect life. Inside, she had the same anxieties and worries and fears I had. I just didn't know it, and she didn't know what I was feeling. So that, in hindsight, there's this wonderful connection. I also get a lot of emails that I just love from people who say things like, I picked up your book because we have the same last name. And I'm like, yes, because that's like the most common Vietnamese name. But it makes me so happy, because it's so amazingly gratifying just when someone knows how to pronounce your name, or just to see your name represented somewhere else in a public space and not feel that it's foreign or weird in some way is such an enormous step forward from what I experienced as a child. My whole day will be made if a TSA agent says my name correctly. You know?
And then lets you on the plane.
Yes, that part too.
What about you, Christina?
What was the question?
It was, what kind of reaction?
I got wrapped up listening to that. No, yeah. Really, it was making me think, but what was your original question?
What was the reaction you received from Panamanian communities or Mexican communities from your book?
I don't know quite. I haven't gotten a lot of responses from Latino readers, although I'm really happy to say that the book was published in Spanish simultaneously with it being in English, and it's the first book of mine that was published in Spanish, so it was the first book of mine that my family was able to read in Panama, which was a big deal for me. But I have gotten a lot of emails from non-Latino readers. And I mean, the biggest compliment that I've gotten from the book, and I've gotten it a few times, is that someone has read it and said to me that after they finished it, they maybe were driving down the street and saw someone waiting at a bus stop who was apparently Latino or apparently Hispanic, and the person thought of that person waiting at the bus stop differently. Mm-hmm. That the person thought to themselves, that person has a story that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is so important and such a... I mean, I didn't set out to have that effect on anybody, but the fact that the book has had that effect is, you know, really overwhelming. It's sort of amazing to me. I mean, I could sort of go on about this, but the thing to me, I think, is, and there's been a lot going on lately that's made me think about this, but we seem to be this nation that's somehow infected by fear lately, and it's fear of each other. And I think that the fear is coming from a lack of understanding each other, and the lack of understanding comes from a few places, but one of them primarily is from the stories that we tell each other about ourselves. And so I think, for me, the epigraph of the book is, let us all be from somewhere, let us tell each other everything we can. And I feel like it's so important to tell those stories and for other people to listen to those stories. And you know, it took me 5 years to write this book, and now coming out of the writing cave and going out and hearing that kind of feedback from readers, that it has maybe changed their mind or made them think a little bit differently about other people, just encountering those stories at all. I mean, I think that's a huge thing.
It's amazing.
I've heard a lot from immigrants, and I think because the journey of leaving one's home for another is the same, no matter where you are coming from. I've also heard a lot from non-immigrants who feel like they have something, like Christina was saying, that they are changing their minds or they are learning something about another person. But I'm always excited to hear from high school students who feel like they are seeing a text that speaks of their experience. So those are my favorite group to hear from.
Oh, yeah, that's got to be gratifying to see to hear from young people who are having this experience.
Mm-hmm. It's really humbling, and it's so important because I don't know about you guys, but when I was growing up, I mean, I was a big reader and a book nerd, but I didn't see myself represented in anything I was reading for the longest time. I mean, probably not until I was in graduate school and I encountered Sandra Cisneros, and then I went on and found like Junot Diaz and like other Latino writers, and I realized, oh my gosh, this could be literature. And it's like about people who are sort of like me and some, like I had no idea that you could put like arroz con pollo in a story and it would be like still in the Oxford American anthology, you know, like was a huge revelation to me. And so I think that's so important when you're talking about like young people and young readers, the idea that maybe we would be giving them something where they could recognize parts of themselves in a book.
Absolutely, and I feel like it also gives them the license to tell their stories too, because I remember that it wasn't until I read Junot Diaz that I understood that it was okay to write the way I talked, for instance. It was okay to write my experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So much of reading for writers is about finding permission.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like Christina, I didn't encounter any work by any Asian Americans until I was in college. So I did not think it was possible. And I remember reading Maxine Hong Kingston's The Woman Warrior for the first time, and being like, oh my God, she's writing about Asian people. Is this okay? Yeah. We're reading this in my class. Is this right? And it changed my life because I hadn't known before that I could write about my own experience and have it be validated in some way. And so the idea that kids can see themselves mm-hmm. in work is so amazing. And I wish that I could go back in time and yeah. give my childhood self mm-hmm. a more diverse reading list.
I feel like it's also about other kids too seeing their friends mm-hmm. in books, because it allows them to understand them better and to appreciate that their experience too is equally valid.
So now we have some questions from our audience. Some of them are specific to the writer, some of them are general. We'll start off with a general question, which is, who influenced, and I'm actually going to combine two questions here since they're a little related. Who in your life influenced you to become a writer, and did any or all of you keep journals as a child?
I would say my grandmother. I had no idea she was influencing me, though, but she did. She was a storyteller, and she told stories throughout our childhood every night. And I think from her and my dad, too, who also loved telling stories, I learned to appreciate language. I learned to pay attention with the ear to stories being told. And when it came to me doing my own writing, because I was coming from that background of orature, I am really obsessed. I'm obsessed about how my lines sound. I always imagine not a reader, really, but somebody hearing my book out loud. So I see my grandmother's and my father's fingerprints on my work. I did not keep a journal, unfortunately. I didn't really have a strong literary childhood. I was out on the street playing and eating guavas. And
good for you.
I feel like somebody, maybe like Taylor, made this question for me. When you hear my answer, you'll know why. So, I mean, it's funny that you say your grandmother, because my grandfather was a writer, and so I think there was some influence there, at least through the bloodlines. But when I was in high school, there was a boy who I had a very, very big crush on, and I used to try to tell him all the time how I felt about him. So we would be at a party, and I would somehow get him in a corner and tell him how much I liked him. And then I would call him late at night and tell him how much I liked him. And finally, one day, he got really sick of it, I guess, and he came into school with a blank journal, and he handed it to me. And he said, "Why don't you write down everything you want to say to me for a year and then give this back to me?" And, you know, because I would have done anything he asked, I said, okay. So I took it home and I started writing. And at first it was really just entries to him about, you know, how great he looked that day, or the funny thing he said in calculus or whatever. And then it just turned into this thing where at the end of every day, I loved sitting down and writing, and I felt like I couldn't live without it. And I was always this good girl who sort of followed the rules. And in that journal, I could do and be whoever I wanted and say all the things that my mother would, you know, lock me up for saying. And I could just, it was like freedom. There was some kind of liberation there. And I kept the journal for the whole year. I did give it back to him at the end of the year. Nothing ever happened. But I mean, and then I kept journals ever since then, and I sort of have never looked back. But I kind of identify that as the moment when I realized how much writing meant to me and that I wanted to be a writer. So
we're in an interesting time in this country where immigration is an immigrant is almost a dirty word. It seems to take on some negative connotations, which is very odd for a country that is essentially been built by immigrants for its entire history. Where do you think, or where do you hope that we're going in this country as far as immigration is concerned, and where do we need to get? Because you're experts now.
This is the part where we're experts.
This is the part where you're experts. People want to know your opinion. How are people, you know, we actually, tonight, while we're all here, do you know that there's a TV show debuting,
Fresh Off the Boat?
We have an immigration comedy.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
First Asian American comedy.
Is that going to make things easier for immigrants, or is that going to say, or is this another point of oh, look, you're different, and we can laugh at you?
I think it makes things easier.
Yeah?
I actually think the best thing about social media is that it makes everyone a little bit more aware. You have to be more aware if you're engaged in social media in any way, because people are going to call out bad behavior more, and that calling out can go viral. And I think that that's a good thing. I reject the negative connotation of immigrant, just as I reject any negative connotation of the word feminist. And I think that's a place to begin, is to reject the negative connotation. There's nothing negative about being an immigrant.
I think a lot of people agree with you. That's an interesting point about social media. Obviously, growing up in the late 70s, early 80s, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have Twitter. But how does the use of social media and texting and cell phones and this connectivity it gives us, does that make immigration a little bit easier for people when they can, you know, you've got characters who are doing FaceTime and Skype with each other around the world or talking on the phone? Is it easier, do you think, to stay connected because of technology now?
Absolutely. Now you can connect to anybody in any part of the world, and with that comes the beauty of learning about other people and recognizing that we are all human. And like Beth was saying, more people get to reject things, negative things that they would not otherwise have been able to, because they would not know the right narrative about people who are different from them. So I feel like technology is a beautiful thing when it comes to raising awareness and increasing our empathy, because we get to understand people better.
Christina, do you have anything to add?
I just, again, I think in terms of the technology, certainly it's a great connector. I mean, for anyone, immigrant or not. I mean, my parents are over in Delaware, and we're on the webcam with them with my kids like three times a day. And, you know, it's fantastic. But, I mean, I think the other upside of it, or the other potential upside of it, is that it's just another way for us to craft and tell our stories. You know, even if it's in just a tweet or if it's in a status update, I mean, you're getting snippets of people's stories that you put together to get a whole, and it's just another way to potentially another avenue for understanding, which again, I think goes back to what I was saying before about, I think that's, you know, that's the way to combat the fear that sometimes we have of each other, and that I think that fear is what gives rise to this whole like cloud of negativity that does seem to envelop the word immigrant, and seems to be specifically aimed these days at Latino immigrants, which I think is unfortunate. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you have to use it in the right ways. Obviously there's potential for abuse, but I think it can be a good thing.
Yep. So Beth, we've got a question for you. Your relationship with your mother is related in the book, very complicated, without giving away too much. What is your relationship with her now?
You mean my relationship with my birth mother?
Yes, with your birth mother.
I have a birth mother and a stepmother.
Both are very complicated.
Both are complicated. Less so with my stepmother, who I call my mom, because she basically was around since I was three. My birth mother did not come to America with us. She didn't come to America until I was in fifth or sixth grade, but I didn't meet her until I was in college. So there's a whole story behind that, much of which is really unclear because nobody in my family ever wanted to talk about it. And that's sort of one of those ideas that I was struggling with throughout my life, which is the unwillingness, rather, to speak about something that would be scary or unpleasant. And it's, I think, part of the reason why I became a writer was because my dad didn't want to tell these stories. And, you know, that silence totally backfired on him. So after I met my mother, we sort of established a relationship, but we're not close at all. She lives in the East Coast. We don't see each other very often. She has her own family. And it's always a little difficult to explain this to people because sometimes people think it's a really sad thing. And I objectively, I see it as, I could see how it would be a sad thing not to be that close to my birth mother, but I think it's because I grew up with a mother and I had a strong matriarchal figure in my grandmother. The relationship I have with my birth mother is a friendly one, but it's like we're distant relatives rather than a mother-daughter type of relationship. And that's how it is for both of us. And that's sort of the story as it's unfolding right now.
And it continues. And you had one of the stranger experiences because, as far as culture clash goes, because you not only had the Vietnamese-American culture clash, you had the Vietnamese-Latino culture clash with Americans. So you had to juggle several things going on at once in that house. And have you sorted all that out from your childhood yet?
Let's see, am I still writing?
you still have things to write about it, because, yeah.
I don't think I've sorted it out. I don't know if I ever will. And that is the great legacy that my parents never intended, for which I'm very grateful. I don't want my children to be writers because I want them to have a happier childhood.
And you don't want them to write about you. Yeah, one of the things that before this started we were talking a little bit about is the geography of the books in America. Here in California, we think, oh, we are the home of all the immigrants. They all come here. Yet we find, no, there are immigrants going to Michigan. There are immigrants going to Delaware. And it created not only a cultural transition for the characters in the books or for your family, but an environmental one, because the conditions in the Midwest, as you've noticed today, are significantly different than they are here and are from Zimbabwe or Latin America or Vietnam. And how much do you think the places where you ended up influenced that story? How much of a character is the geographic location in the United States where you ended up in this book?
Well, I set the book in Delaware partly because I was born there, but also because I know you guys were waiting for the great Delaware novel. But it became important to me actually. Like halfway through writing the book, I was talking to a friend about it and about the fact that it was set in Delaware, and she was so surprised that there would be any Latino immigrants in Delaware. Mm. And I was surprised that she was surprised because I grew up, you know, there's like a very sizable population. And part of the reason, as gets explicated in the book, is because there are these mushroom farms across the state line in Pennsylvania that historically have brought laborers to come work there, and then they would live across the state line in Delaware, where it's a little bit more economically feasible. Mm-hmm. But they have roots there now, and you know, real communities. And it was important to me then to keep the book set there, specifically because people would be surprised. It seemed important to say, this is not a story that's happening only in California, or in Texas, or in Arizona, or in New York. This is a story that's happening all over the country. It's really an American story. And so for me, yeah, I mean, it was fun to sort of throw in all the stuff from Delaware, but it became actually very significant to me that it was set in a place that you would maybe not suspect.
Well, the weather, like, keys in to part of your story significantly.
Right. I mean, there's a whole thing about snow, and that that changes a lot of the plot elements of the book, and, you know, that couldn't have happened in a place like Texas, maybe. So, yeah, there was definitely some narrative reasons to have it set there as well.
Val?
I lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It was and is still my home base because my aunt is there and two sisters and their kids. So I felt like that was my America. That was the America I kind of knew as an 18-year-old studying college. And of course, that's where I encountered snow for the first time, and it left a very lasting impression that I had to subject my protagonist to. But I also had no idea when I came how big this country was, really, until I started moving here and there for college and experiencing different communities. That's when my eyes kind of opened up to not only how big it is, but also how diverse, because Kalamazoo wasn't as diverse as Oakland, where I am, for instance. And actually, it wasn't until I moved to the Bay that I felt like I have come to a place that sort of recognizes me, that sort of makes me forget some of my issues, because it's a place where, like I said before, where you're always seeing people from all over.
Mm-hmm. We've reached the part of our program for our last question, and this will be a forward-looking question. We've all devoured your books for this program. What are you working on now? What can we look forward to?
Who has the next one coming out?
Not me.
No, I know.
I'll just say I'm working on essays that are sort of a sequel to Stealing Buddha's Dinner. It's about high school, music, and bad TV shows.
I wish I knew. Yeah. I mean, I am like in the very, very nascent stages of something, maybe, that I don't know. I can't even tell yet what it is, if it's going to be anything. It's like a bubble in my brain, and I feel like if I talk about it or even like think about it too much, it's going to, pop. And it's just fragile, and it's sitting there, and I'm doing everything I can to protect it. So it's like...
I'm working on a collection of stories, but it's slow going. I'm not even comfortable talking about it as well.
Excellent. Yeah.
We're
okay.
So superstitious.
No. I'm not going to tell you what I'm writing about tomorrow either. You'll have to pick up a newspaper. Well, thank you very much for participating in this program with us.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to your experiences over the next couple of months. And thank you for taking part in this interview tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.